I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, your community-powered radio station. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning, the Old Mole collective of artists, scholars, and activists tunnel underground to root out the larger significance behind recent events and provide interviews, reviews, and views that we hope lead to greater understanding, reflection, and action. I'm your host, Laurie Mercier. Engineering is Carl Vandervoort. Our theme today is how we prevent the erasure of history, so important in our efforts to obtain social and economic justice, as did Carter G. Woodson, initiator of Black History Month, which we celebrate each February. Son of former slaves and a coal miner who, while studying at Harvard, was disturbed to find that history books largely ignored African Americans, except when in inferior roles. He took on the challenge of writing Black Americans into the nation's history and in 1926 launched Black History Week to bring national attention to their contributions. This morning, we moles will bring to light the work of those the powerful would like to keep buried. First, Bill Resnick will talk with James Straub, a writer and labor organizer in Las Vegas, about how deindustrialization and the rise of Christian fundamentalism have moved states in the Rust Belt to the right, and how a former working-class militancy might be revived. Allison Weir, from Los Angeles and the director of If Americans Knew, a group exposing the failure of the U.S. media to adequately cover the Israel-Palestine conflict, will join us in the studio in advance of talks she is giving in Portland and Vancouver this week. Then the movie moles, Denise Morris and Fran Michelle, will review the classic documentary about the Vietnam War directed by Peter Davis, Hearts and Minds. And finally, I'll be interviewing Cynthia Griggs Fleming, historian and author of Soon We Will Not Cry, about the life and liberation of Ruby Doris Smith Robinson, key activist in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee of the 1960s. And here is Bill Resnick interviewing James Straub.
Hi, James. Are you there?
Hi, Bill. Right here.
Good. Let me introduce you. James Straub is a writer and a union organizer. He was recently based in Ohio, in Cincinnati, Youngstown, and other cities. He's now in Las Vegas. His latest article is in the January issue of the Monthly Review magazine. It's titled, What Was the Matter with Ohio? Unions and Evangelicals in the Rust Belt. James Straub, give us your take on why so many working class voters supported Bush in the last election.
Well, there's a couple different traditional left-wing or progressive perspectives on this. One old one would be a sort of Marxist or revolutionary perspective, especially that comes out of 60s radicalism. And that idea is that there's a material historical problem with the white working class, that a big chunk of the working class in the United States and other states that were settled by, colonized and populated by white migrants from Europe, that the white working class, and especially the white male working class in those states, has often allied with the power structure against the rest of the working class, and for that they're rewarded with various privileges, and symbolic and otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
That's one perspective on what leads to that.
The privilege was the best way to survive, rather than ally down to the legions of people of color who were really kept in servitude. They decided to take their privilege.
Mm-hmm.
They may not have liked the bosses, but being privileged was a better position than being stuck on the bottom.
Yeah.
And there's a couple ways. There's been
some very great and insightful recent books about this sort of thing by people like Noel Ignatieff, who wrote a book called How the Irish Became White,
right.
And especially a recent book called by David Roediger called The Working Towards Whiteness,
right.
Which was about how the New Deal industrial unions was partly an extension of white supremacy to the new immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But that's one perspective on why things like this happen. A more recent one, and more of just a soft left or progressive one, is what you'll find in Thomas Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas, which is that a lot of, blue-collar, ordinary white people, and otherwise, feel a certain amount of cultural distance or disenfranchisement from the sort of the urban knowledge elites, people who live in the Northeast and on the West Coast and who are culturally sophisticated, who the sitcoms are made for, who the products are advertised to, and who, are perceived as feeling themselves very much above those hicks and flyover country.
Mm-hmm.
And so people, feel a certain amount of cultural distance from them, and that the Republicans harness that sentiment by using the language of class warfare and talking about how the problem with elites in the United States is one of a problem with latte liberals who drive Volvos.
And who make rules for their lives and who have ruined the economy and who have elevated blacks above them and all of these sorts of lines, right?
Yeah, so that's another that's another more recent perspective. I think those are both very insightful and true to an extent. Something that I think the left should think more about is there's an organizational component to this too, right? Like in the past, in the Rust Belt, states of the northern Midwest, there used to be the biggest grassroots political organizations used to be the industrial unions, mass movements of many, many millions of people who won amazing gains in social democracy through often very bloody and vicious and heroic confrontations with their employers and the tyrants of their lives. And those organizations have been destroyed, partly by deindustrialization and, things like NAFTA. And also partly because just the rightward shift of the time and the gradual smashing of the unions through offshoring and through the just boss counterattack through the 80s and 90s. And so at the same time as the industrial unions have declined, what's risen even more rapidly than, the unions have declined has been the evangelical churches, which have expanded out from the Southwest and Southern California, where they originated in the United States, and became sort of a nationwide movement. And for the sort of new working class, blue collar, ordinary people who live in exurbs or suburbs, they're probably the biggest political presence, and they're incredible ideological organizers. So something that's interesting about the evangelicals is not just that they pander to people's small-mindedness or bigotry, but they are actually they have a coherent ideology, and they're built on a grassroots organizing model. Every evangelical church that is growing because, central to your conception of God is the idea that you have to spread the faith. You have to develop your ability to proselytize. You bring your neighbors to church. You talk about it with other people. You spread the word of God. So they've grown while, the left and the unions and everything else has shrunk. Mm-hmm. So there's been sort of an organizational component, too.
Let's explore. Well, let me do a station ID first. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm Bill Resnick for the Old Mole, talking to James Straub, who's a writer and union organizer. He was based in Ohio, now he's in Las Vegas. We've been talking about why so many working class voters have gone right and even support George Bush. Let's bracket the question of organization and get back to that, James. Let me ask you, though, you mentioned Thomas Frank's hypothesis that sort of working class resentment has been targeted at sort of Eastern and coastal liberals and the kind of liberal elitism. And, of course, that's true. But why did working class resentment is not only, it seems to me, even still, there's a tremendous amount of resentment, not just at sort of liberal elites, but at corporate elites, at those people who are stealing everything from them, at the Enrons, at the people who are taking their pensions. It seems to me working people know they're getting screwed, and that their incomes are falling. They're working harder for less, and Clinton's memorable phrase that he didn't act upon. It seems to me that's not unknown to people, and in fact, in public opinion polls, they express it. Why, though, is this sort of in voting patterns, and why is it so easy to fan the flames against Eastern liberals, but not, in fact, build real anger and activity against sort of the corporate elites?
Mm-hmm. Well, for one thing, neither of the two main parties does it, and certainly the Democrats don't try to fan the flames of anger against the corporate elites. They really couldn't. I mean, that's their resource base. That's who they are as well. There isn't an enormous presence of explicitly left-wing folks trying to build a new movement in these places, these Akron, Ohio, and Springfield, you know, these kinds of small dying cities where people are really getting screwed. There isn't a huge left-wing presence. If anything, there's a perspective from people who do live there that that's something for the people in the college towns, for people in Berkeley or Madison. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, here
well,
in Dayton,
you know, Stoughton Lynn, though, I'm sure you knew him in Ohio, mm-hmm. right? And the retired people's movement retired steel workers.
Mm-hmm.
There were various movements in Youngstown that were pretty strong, including the Youngstown churches. I remember went to one of the services back in the, whenever it was, 1981 or something like that, when Youngstown was really deindustrializing. And I was in Youngstown for a while. Mm-hmm. It seems to me there was a lot of organizing in Youngstown.
Stoughton Lynn did amazing work there. Stoughton Lynn was somebody from the New Left who had been active in things like SNCC and the Civil Rights Movement and the anti-war movement. And in the late 60s, early 70s, when it appeared that almost every sector of American society was in rebellion against the power structure except for most, white industrial working class people, a lot of leftists started to fan out throughout the country and get jobs as auto workers or carpenters or steel workers. And they built rank and file caucuses.
There were
in the
huge
union.
Wildcats, actually.
Wildcat strikes everywhere.
In the early 80s. Yeah.
And the idea was you'd just get a job, you'd build a caucus in your union, you'd try and take power away from the old corrupt bureaucrats who ran them. And meanwhile, you're talking to the, the men and women who you work next to about the bigger social issues, right? So Stoughton Lynn was one of the folks who did this. Him and his wife, Alice, they met some old left steel workers in Youngstown, Ed Mann and John Barbero, who were sort of these old school, old left guys who, they had been involved in Socialist Party organizing in prior decades, and they described themselves as members of as steel workers who wished they were in the IWW.
Mm-hmm.
And, these are the kind of guys who never gave up the faith with the old left. They used to distribute pamphlets against the Korean War in their plants back then in the 50s. So when Stoughton and Alice Lynn met these people, they did amazing heroic work. They actually moved to a place like Youngstown that does not have a lot of attraction for up-and-coming great leftist writer to move to. And they just settled down and got to work and built an amazing local labor left. They built rank-and-file caucuses and steel workers' unions there. They helped organize wildcat strikes in that place. They did support work for a prison uprising that happened mm-hmm. there.
Along with a lot of people there who were
along
doing
with
it. I mean,
absolutely. I mean, this was an amazing local movement in Youngstown.
Mm-hmm.
And Youngstown still has a great, huge, blue-collar anti-war movement that springs from a lot of work those people in those organizations did back then. I remember John Barbero, one of those steel workers, he used to introduce himself at local anti-war meetings by saying that his parents were Czech and Italian, and his wife was Japanese. So he was anti-war because in any conceivable war, he would have to fight a relative. It was very great, vibrant, down-to-earth, ordinary people's leftism that I think is really what a lot of us who want to rebuild a radical or revolutionary movement in the United States, we should look to doing things like that, to being involved and engaged in ordinary people's communities and building stuff for the long haul.
Mm-hmm.
What those folks did was amazing.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm Bill Resnick for The Old Mole, talking to James Straub. We're talking about white working class people and the dilemmas of rebuilding a left in a time of corporate power and the rising evangelical movement. You argued, James Straub, that people turn to the evangelicals, that they become vulnerable to that whole worldview because of a lack of, I mean, one thing, other worldviews are not prominent and are not being offered to them, and the organizing is poor, and particularly because the labor union movement has been weakened on the defensive and isn't able to defend their interests and is and doesn't provide that sort of core of organization as it used to for maintaining those social democratic and radical and small-d democratic sentiments. I know you have an ideal of rebuilding that kind of social unionism, of a radical unionism, of a not just a business union, not a business unionism, but one that really unites the community around working class popular goals. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, one of many things that must be done is, and is already begun, is the rebuilding of the labor movement in the United States. You know, the unions weren't just dying just because the plants are moving to China. The union movement's been on the defensive and under a vicious boss counterattack and, you know, just shrinking its numbers everywhere, not just in situations where the plants close and move. A lot of that, like you sort of pointed out, too, is problems with the old style of unionism. And but, you know, now things are starting to turn around. Some unions, like the one I work for, hospital and healthcare workers in SEIU, also the Communications Workers of America, Unite Here is another big one. These are unions that are based in things that industries that, first of all, can't really be offshored. And these unions have adopted incredibly aggressive, ruthless organizing, industry-wide organizing tactics. So because of this, I mean, for instance, the union I work for is on track to organize between 1 and 200,000 new workers this year. And so unions that do this and get serious and orient themselves like a social movement and put the resources into it, have a smart strategy and organize industrially, are actually rebuilding union density in places like Ohio. Mm-hmm. So I used to work there, right? And the people who I would talk to about forming unions were people who, you know, work in nursing homes and make very little money taking care of poor elderly folks. Or they work in hospitals, right? They don't have free family health care, but they work in a hospital. So you'll sometimes have people who are, you know, right, a nurse's aide whose children don't have health care.
Right. James, we have just about another 30 seconds. One final thing that you have to how do we organize those people on an industrial basis, but in fact build their power to, in fact, talk to others and speak and run the union? You know, there's a critique is that it's been quite, that it's been too top-down, the SEU, EIU, Unite strategy. You don't have much time to reply, but give us just a little sense. 20 seconds.
Well, the work remains to be done. People just need to put their shoulders to the grindstone and do it, because we can definitely turn the country around. So, you know.
And people are hungry for actually a critique, it seems to me, is what we talked about earlier on the phone. James Straub, thanks a lot for talking to us.
And glad for having me, Bill.
Your article is in the January Monthly Review. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill. Bye.
Right.
Here in Northeast Ohio, back in 1803, James and Danny Heaton found the ore that was lying in Yellow Creek. They built a blast furnace there along the shore, and they made the cannonballs that helped the Union win the war. Here in Youngstown, here in Youngstown, my sweet Jenny, I'm sinking down here, darling, in Youngstown. Well, my daddy worked the furnace, kept him hotter than hell. I come home from now, I'm working my way to Scarborough. That job would suit the devil as well. They were tacking that coke and limestone, fed my children, made my bed. Them smokestacks reaching like the arms of God into a beautiful sky, soot and clay. Here in Youngstown, here in Youngstown, sweet Jenny, I'm sinking down. Here, darling, in Youngstown. Well, my daddy come on the Ohio Works when he come home from World War II. Now the yard's just scrapping rubble. He said them big boys did what Hitler couldn't do. Yeah, these mills, they built the tanks and bombs that won this country's war. We sent our sons to Korea and Vietnam. Now we're wondering what they were dying for. Here in Youngstown, here in Youngstown, my sweet Jenny, I'm sinking down. Here, darling.
Thank you, Bill Resnick and James Straub. I'm now joined in the studio by Allison Weir, a freelance journalist and founder and director of If Americans Knew. She's going to be appearing Tuesday and Wednesday in several venues in Portland and Vancouver to talk about the U.S. and Israel-Palestine, what the media leave out. And we'll announce those places where she's speaking a little later. But tell us, Allison, about this group, If Americans Knew, and why you started it.
Well, thank you so much for having me today. What happened is, as you mentioned, my background is in journalism. And about 5 years ago, I was the editor of the Sausalito newspaper, just writing about local issues. But the current Palestinian uprising began. And I just grew a little bit curious about that. I'd never looked into the issue before. I'm not Arab, Muslim, Jewish, and I just thought it really didn't have anything to do with me, but I was curious about it. So when I paid attention to the news coverage, I did fairly quickly notice that it seemed to me I was hearing much more the Israeli point of view, and I wasn't getting nearly as much information about the Palestinian aspect. That made me curious as a journalist to look into it more and to pay more attention, use the internet to start researching it, and as I did that, it became clearer and clearer that I was reading incidents that happened every day that were not being reported in the mainstream media. After a few months of this, it drew me in more and more. I was astonished at what it seemed to me I was beginning to learn about this issue and the lack of coverage of it. So after about 4, maybe 5 months of really looking at this, I finally decided I'm a journalist. I need to go over there and see firsthand what's going on and report on it just fully, as do the best I can. And so I quit my job as editor of the Sausalito paper, bought a round-trip ticket, and went over and traveled throughout Gaza and the West Bank as a freelance journalist without any organization sponsoring me or guiding me around. And I saw the incredible facts there. So when I came back, I felt an obligation to inform Americans about this issue, and I started this organization, If Americans Knew.
And what have you been doing since starting this group?
Well, one of the things we've done that I think is so essential is actually researching the coverage in the U.S. media, in the New York Times, in the major networks. Some groups that we work with have done local studies. We feel that we need to really get accurate data on this. We don't want pro-Palestinian coverage. We don't want pro-Israeli coverage. We just think Americans need to know what's going on, especially since we give such a large amount of our tax money to Israel. We really need to know, especially we need to be well-informed on this issue. And so we've done these very clear statistical studies where we've looked at how deaths were covered by our media, both in the full news reports and in the headline coverage. It's our view that all deaths are equally tragic, that I think most Americans share the view that all human beings deserve respect, and we want to just know the facts without bias. So we've looked at how they cover the percentage of Israeli deaths they cover compared to the percentage of Palestinian deaths they cover. And across the board, we have found enormous distortion and disparity. Now, to give a local example, for example, with the Oregonian, I think all of us are especially troubled by the deaths of children in this conflict. Large quantities of civilians on both sides are being killed, and children among both populations are being killed. This is enormously tragic and troubling to us. So it's especially significant to look at how these newspapers are covering the deaths of children. And what the group that worked here, and then we looked through their data, make sure they were correct, we consulted on the methodology, etc. They found that, for example, the Oregonian headline coverage of children's deaths covered Israeli children's deaths at a rate 44 times greater than they were covering Palestinian children's deaths. That during the study period, there had been 8 Israeli children who had tragically been killed during the 6-month study period, and 116 Palestinian children who had been tragically killed during that study period. And yet the Oregonian reports on deaths of children had more reports on Israeli children's deaths than Palestinian children's deaths, despite the fact that Palestinian children were being killed at a rate 15 times greater than Israeli children.
I think some of these empirical statistical studies confirm what many of us imagined or mm-hmm. assumed just from our own impressions of the media coverage. But what do we do about this data? How do we bring about change in the way the media covers not only Israel, Israel and Palestine, but other conflicts such as Iraq and what's happening in Iran? I mean, how do we alter this kind of media bias?
Thank you for that. That's such an important question, because I do think it will take all of us working on this issue in general, but especially on the Israeli-Palestinian one. It really will take everybody that cares about just full, honest, accurate reporting to make that known and to help on this issue. So there are a number of things that we all need to do. We certainly need to contact our media and tell them we want full accurate coverage and ask them to improve their coverage. Now the Oregonian, for example, has a clear study on their coverage that shows immense distortion, way outside the bounds of what would be considered proper journalistic practice. This was presented to the Oregonian in March. They have looked at the report fully. They did not dispute the findings. And yet, good journalistic practice would have required them to do a news story on this report to inform their readers and to undertake whatever is necessary to improve their coverage. They have not informed their readers, and there's no indication that they've undertaken the kind of internal study that needs to be done to improve their coverage. So it's now time for the local community to contact the paper and tell them we want full coverage. We don't want to hear one side or the other.
Well, Allison Weir, thank you for coming into KABU today, and I know KABU listeners will be interested in hearing more about your media analyses and about your work in Israel-Palestine, and people can come to a number of events. You're speaking tomorrow, February 7th at 7 p.m. at St. Francis Church. That's Southeast 12th and Pine. Also tomorrow afternoon at the PCC Cascade campus in Northeast Portland, at the Student Center cafeteria. That's sponsored by the PCC Peace and Conflict Studies program. And then on Wednesday, February 8th, from 2 to 3 p.m., at WSU Vancouver, the Salmon Creek Campus Student Services Building, Room 129. And all of those talks are free and open to the public. And thanks very much for your work with the group If Americans Knew. And people can do a Google search to find out more about If Americans Knew and its analysis of media coverage of Israel-Palestine. Now, next up, we have the Movie Moles, Fran Michel and Denise Morris, reviewing the classic film about Vietnam, Hearts and Minds.
Hey, Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with Denise Morris to discuss Hearts and Minds, the Oscar-winning 1974 documentary about the Vietnam War, now available on Criterion DVD at the Multnomah County Library, as well as at Trilogy Movie Madness and other local independent video stores. Using both archival newsreel clips and footage of interviews and other scenes shot by director Peter Davis's film crew in Vietnam, America, and Paris, the film traces U.S. involvement in the conflict from the end of the Second World War, when the U.S. began helping France try to regain control of its former colony. We see Eisenhower both articulate the U.S. desire for the area's tin and tungsten and suggest the domino theory. The Cold War idea that if one country became communist, it would influence another and another and another to do the same. We see Lyndon Johnson noting, as he escalated American involvement in the Vietnam War, that the ultimate victory will depend on the hearts and minds of the people who actually live out there. But the film is even more concerned with the hearts and minds of Americans. Many of those interviewed are veterans, often missing legs or arms, and though all had supported or at least not questioned the war when they enlisted, only one has maintained that attitude at the time of the interviews. We also hear from other disillusioned former supporters of the war, like Clark Clifford and Daniel Ellsberg, the latter famous for releasing the Pentagon Papers about secret plans for the war. But we also hear from a few pro-war voices, like Walt Rostow and General Westmoreland, who tells us that the Oriental doesn't put the same high value on life as a Westerner. Life is cheap in the Orient. This comes right after scenes of mourners wailing at a South Vietnamese funeral. Director Davis says he wanted to explore the questions of why did we go there, what did we do, and what did it do to us? And we can talk about those questions today and also about the question of the relevance and meaning of this movie for us as viewers 30 years later, 30-some, more than 30 years later.
Yeah, it's all too unfortunate that this film resonates. And Hearts and Minds, just the title of the film itself, Hearts and Minds, is so loaded in our culture now. We've heard it with any recent war or any recent conflict, that this is not just a nice way of looking at a group of people that we care about their hearts and minds, but it's part of a program, which is basically the idea that, you know, subjugating a population to the will of the conquerors is moral behavior. We need something from them, and we will get it one way or another, and hopefully we'll do it by convincing them that it's the right thing for them.
Yeah, and the illusion that we maintain the illusion that we can convince them by bombing them that we're really on their side.
Yes.
And that we're going to really help them out and bring them freedom and all that good stuff. People who bring you the bombs and the napalm and so on.
And wouldn't it be wild if, like Eisenhower, the Bush administration just came out and said, we need their oil. Instead of dancing around the idea, maybe something that has changed is the sophistication of masking your message.
Yeah, Ellsberg in the film says something about, I mean, he goes through sort of the list of Eisenhower lied and Kennedy lied and Johnson lied and lied and lied and Nixon lied, and he mentions that it's a credit to the American people that they needed, their leaders perceived that they needed to be lied to, although of course not a credit that it was so easy to lie to us. But the lies have gotten more extensive, have gotten bigger, have gotten wider play in more recent years. We now have the records of the lies that were involved in the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which Johnson got passed through the Senate and House to approve the escalation of American involvement in Vietnam. And, you know, we have documentation from, of all places, the NSA that was based on a lie. And so we can recognize it in retrospect, but it's much harder to see the lies that are going on today. What it's done to us has apparently not been particularly educational for us as a people.
Yes. There's one reviewer who said that he felt Hearts and Minds should be one of the five films that each student should have to see before they leave school. High school, I guess, being, you know, at the high school level. And the film really, I think in some ways it demonstrates that Vietnam is the playbook for how to kind of run a war and how to convince your a population to participate, what kinds of rewards are meted out for the soldiers who participate, and that it's really it's not just a fluke that people are saying, you know, it's Vietnam all over again, and that raises the people's uncertainties, or you know, but it's really true, and it's not just because we think we're going to be involved in a long protracted war. It's because of this this way that it unfolds,
and it's really striking how little, indeed, we seem to have learned, and how that playbook has been rewritten, has been misinterpreted, has been misread, and was misread even at the time. One of the soldiers, the one veteran who is still supportive of the war and really kind of comes off as, I find him a little zombie-like, because he really doesn't seem to have much emotion in his speech, but he does a lot of public speaking. And at one point, as he's speaking to a group of children at a school, he tells them that we won the war. And so, I mean, there is this illusion, even apparently on the part of soldiers who had been there and were living through this period, that Vietnam was in some way a success. Slightly less surrealistic version of events comes from Walt Rostow, who was an advisor to several presidents, and he says that, well, you know, he thought in retrospect that, you know, the strategic aims were important, that Vietnam was important for us. It was an area of the world where it was important for us to have control, but he wishes that there had been a more decisive military strategy. And I hear this from a lot of people today, that the idea that Vietnam might have been won had we fought it differently. And I think one of the things that this film really stresses, that Hearts and Minds really stresses, is that, as one of the characters says, it's not a matter of strategy when you're fighting people who are fighting for their freedom and fighting for their independence and fighting for their homeland, that it's not a question of just finding a better way to fight the war. They're not going to give up. They don't want us there.
Right. There's some amazing footage that Davis has captured. One of them is the filming of the reenactment of the American Revolution, and it's played against a conversation with, I believe, a priest, a Vietnamese priest, who talks about Ho Chi Minh's letter writing campaign. He was writing letters to Eisenhower, I believe, and asking for help in their fight against colonialism, the French at the time. But we were actively supporting the French, so there wasn't going to be an answer to that letter. But I think we would be hard pressed today to find any leader of any country that would willingly look to America for help against colonialism, because we're seen as a colonial power.
Yeah, I mean, we've certainly made that transition from being the colony fighting off the British who were repressing us and taking away our rights, to being the agent of that sort of repression and deprivation of rights of other peoples around the world. And much of the rest of the world seems to have realized this. It's not always clear that Americans have as uniformly figured this out.
It's true. I think, you know, Hearts and Minds really does explore the personal lives and hopeful transition that soldiers who fought in that war went through. They are people who enlisted and willingly enlisted, chose to be there, and had varying degrees of change in their lives. One very I think important link from the past to the present is this idea that a soldier dies for a noble cause, and I find it a little bit more disillusioning now to hear this continuing sentiment among parents who are willingly giving their children over to another imperial war. We thought that we wouldn't see another war. The war to end all wars was supposed to be World War II, then Vietnam, and we've just continued. And I think, you know, someone like Cindy Sheehan in our modern times is the mother who says, I think that's bogus. I mean, she's saying it publicly, and she's rallying other mothers, and that they're, you know, we're seeing a building anti-war sentiment, but But to still be in this place and to still be struggling around these same questions is very can be very disillusioning. We hope to find outlets to undo that. Hearts and Minds is a great film, and I think that it's always nice to go back. We have a film coming our way, which is partly why we thought we'd look at Hearts and Minds a bit today, and that is Why We Fight, and that will be at Cinema 21 starting on the 10th of February, and it'll run through the 16th, so folks can support Cinema 21, a great opportunity to do that. That film will explore much more of the political, imperial policies that have led us into war and American militarism.
And the economic basis of the motives for war, as well as the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower talked about. But we also recommend Hearts and Minds. It's a very rich film. There are a lot of important lessons to be gained from it, and it's well worth seeing. For The Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel, here with Denise Morris, talking about Hearts and Minds.
Thank you, Fran and Denise, for reminding us about Hearts and Minds, a valuable film about the Vietnam War. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm Laurie Mercier, and joining me on the phone is Cynthia Griggs Fleming, professor of history at University of Tennessee and author of numerous publications about the civil rights movement, including her recent book, In the Shadow of Selma, The Continuing Struggle for Civil Rights in the South, and another book we want to talk about today, Soon We Will Not Cry, The Liberation of Ruby Doris Smith Robinson. Welcome to KBOO, Dr. Fleming.
Thank you very much.
Our theme today on the show has been how to prevent the erasure from memory of critical events and people who have much to teach us about building movements for social change. And we all know that Rosa Parks and Coretta Scott King are two visible civil rights activists who have recently passed away. But there are many other unsung heroes of the black freedom struggle
Yes. You
describe in your work. And one of these is Ruby Doris Smith Robinson.
Yes.
So tell us about her and her role in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which, for those who don't know, it was a critical movement of the mid to late 1960s.
Yes, Ruby Doris Smith Robinson was a remarkable woman, partly because she was so young when she started movement work. She was only 17 years old, and because I teach on the university level, I just marvel at how much she was able to accomplish, and she's the age of many of the students I teach. She worked in the movement from the time she was 17 until she died at age 25. She died very young, also in the movement. And Ruby Doris was the kind of person who, once she became committed to the cause, she did not look left nor right. She did whatever was necessary in order to ensure equal rights for people. When she began working in the movement, she's a native of Atlanta, and when she began working in the movement, she was a freshman at Spelman College in Atlanta, and she began sit-ins when the Atlanta student movement started in 1960, and right away people around her recognized that she had a special talent. In addition to being willing to go out there on the front lines and picket and protest and go to jail, she was almost an organizational genius. She understood that after all was said and done, because the young people really, really were committed to the cause, and they, in a strange way, almost enjoyed having the opportunity to put their bodies on the lines for freedom. But somebody had to be back in the office doing the unglamorous work that would keep the whole thing in place. And that's eventually where Ruby Doris really made a remarkable contribution to the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and to the movement by extension.
Well, one thing I was impressed by your research was that organizational genius and willingness of Robinson to do that kind of unglamorous work,
yes,
which we all in various struggles need to remember. But also, as in all progressive social movements, SNCC was fraught with divisions over strategies and politics.
Oh, yes.
But Smith Robinson had this amazing ability to navigate and mediate those tensions, which to me seems very instructive for the left today. How did she manage to push the movement forward and at the same time acknowledge and keep differences from splitting the movement apart?
Yes, I think you really have put your finger on it. I remember recently here at the University of Tennessee, we have had some student organizations that have grown out of events that have happened here. and you see those kinds of divisions surface almost right away. And in no time at all, people are at each other's throats. And I marvel at how Ruby was able to rise above all of that. I think what she did that other people who I've been around and witnessed trying to organize have been maybe not quite as successful as she, is that she was always able to keep focused on the end result of what she wanted to have happen, instead of letting all those petty divisions and jealousies and rivalries draw her into their realm and to derail her from the real purpose. And she was the one, people in SNCC tell me, because I interview a lot of her SNCC colleagues, people in SNCC tell me that she was the one that was always reminding them what the end result had to be and just put all this stuff aside and get over it.
Well, another of the many interesting features of your book, and I'm speaking with Cynthia Griggs Fleming, author of Soon We Will Not Cry, a book about the life and liberation of Ruby Doris Smith Robinson, a leading student nonviolent coordinating committee activist. Was your challenge of the critiques that white feminists have made, especially in the years following SNCC's strength in the 70s and the 80s, that SNCC was a sexist organization, I mean, certainly a product of its times, that privileged patriarchy and male domination.
Yeah.
But from looking at Smith Robinson's role in the movement, what is the more complicated story here about gender roles and relations?
Yeah, that's something that I have a definite advantage over many other scholars when I try to navigate that minefield, because it is a very complex picture. Because I'm really close in age to Ruby Doris Smith Robinson, black, female, and from a major urban area, I understood certain nuances that many other people would not understand. And I think one of the major things that a lot of people misunderstood, scholars misunderstood when they looked back at Ruby's life, they did not understand that for young black women of that time period, and I'm talking about those born in the 1940s and who came of age in the late 50s and early 60s, race was such an end-all be-all of their existence that gender, although it mattered so much less than it did to white women at the time. And you have to understand that in order to understand how Ruby stayed focused in the places where she did, because in talking to black SNCC women who were colleagues of Ruby's and who were around her age, that was the question I kept asking over and over again, how important was gender to you? And they all answered me by saying, although it was important, there was always that proviso at the beginning, although it was important, race so starkly defined our lives that we had to deal with that first. And so that's one of the things that helped me to understand how Ruby, although gender did matter, and I think had Ruby lived, it would have begun to matter more. But at the stage of development where she was as a very young woman, race had showed itself to be the most compelling aspect of the limitations on her existence in America in the 1960s. And so that is how she sort of navigated that whole question of gender and race. Gender was important, but at that point in her development, race was much more important.
Well, and what were the impressions of some of these black activists you interviewed about their, I mean, these black women, about their own roles in SNCC and the degree to which they felt like they had an element of power or were engaged in the active shaping of SNCC's politics?
They did feel that they had a fair amount of power over policy and over policy-making decisions in the organization. And let me just back up for just a minute. Part of what anyone who looks at this era has to understand about these young people is that they came out of situations, out of families and communities, where black women were activists. So that was a role that was expected of black women. And in many black families, black men and black women, and I'm talking about black middle-class families, black men and black women shared responsibilities like financial decision-making and so forth that did not go on in white families. So these young people came out of a tradition where black women were actors in many senses of the word. So when they formed their own organization, it was just natural for them to continue in the same fashion. And so black women, these young black women, expected to make some of the decisions, expected to have a certain amount of power. Now, having said that, it's important to understand, though, they also knew that it was a male-dominated society and that black families, even though black women had a certain amount of decision-making power, that still there was the notion, even if it was in the backs of people's minds, that the man was still the leader. And so they sort of navigated that position between having some power but understanding that they lived in a male-dominated society.
And it's interesting, too, that Ruby Doris Smith Robinson chose to marry.
Yes.
And here she was, such a powerful figure in SNCC, and at a young age kind of chose that more traditional path of marrying and then having a child.
Yes.
But she really did try to continue her activism despite the kind of the new boundaries that family life might have laid upon her.
Yes, she did, and that also speaks to the fact that the way middle-class black young women were raised, and even if they weren't middle-class, even if their families were not middle-class in terms of their finances, but middle-class in terms of their aspirations, the notion was that young black women were being raised to do it all. There was no contradiction in the minds of so many people between having a family life and doing what would have been considered the quote-unquote normal things, marrying, having a baby or babies and so forth, and at the same time having a career, having roles and a goal outside of the home. So there wasn't the same kind of notion that there was a contradiction between those two roles within black middle-class society of that era.
Mm-hmm. Now, Cynthia Fleming, when I've mentioned to people that I was going to be talking with you today about Ruby Doris Smith Robinson, people who are very familiar with SNCC and the black freedom struggle of the 60s, many had not heard of Ruby Doris Smith Robinson. Why do you suppose she's not remembered?
There are a couple of reasons for that. The most obvious, of course, is that when the movement was first written about in the early years after the movement, people automatically seized upon the male leaders who were the ones who were the most publicized and out front. But at the same time, it's important to recognize that people like Ruby Doris Smith Robinson, Ella Baker, and others, and they were mostly women, and I'm still trying to figure out what that means exactly in my own work, but these women, I have run across tantalizing references in the literature where they will actually make statements to colleagues in meetings that we shouldn't get too far out in front of our colleagues in the press. What we need to make sure is that we don't have too much publicity for our individual roles because we want to make sure we don't overshadow the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so Ruby Doris, that was one of the most frustrating things about the project for me. She tried very hard to work behind the scenes because she didn't want any undue recognition. She understood, and it still is remarkable to me that she was such a sophisticated thinker at such an early age, she understood that if she began to get a lot of publicity for her role, that could very well change the dynamic between her work and the organization that she was attempting to shape.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't want that to happen. So as a scholar looking at her life, it was very difficult for me to find even things like photographs. I mean, she didn't want to be photographed particularly. She just did not want to be out front because she was afraid of what that would do.
Mm-hmm. Well, what lessons do both SNCC and Ruby Doris Smith Robinson have to teach us today for those of us involved in various struggles for social justice? Smith Robinson was frustrated by some of the divisions that emerged in SNCC, and certainly after her untimely death, those divisions continued to rupture the organization.
Yes, unfortunately.
But what lessons does that movement of the late 60s have for us today in our various struggles?
I think the most important lesson it has is it shows us that anybody can make a difference. And I get, as a scholar of the civil rights movement, as a person who has devoted an entire career to teaching African American history, I get so frustrated this time of year when people, and I don't get me wrong, I enjoy going to various places and making speeches about Dr. King's life and work. His life and work was critical, but if we could resurrect him and bring him here and sit in my living room and put him on the phone with me, he would be the first one to say that I didn't do this. All these nameless, faceless people did it. Unfortunately, we as a society seem to be sitting around looking for somebody else to lead us, And it's up to each one of us, and I think that's the most important lesson of the civil rights movement of the 1960s, is that it was a grassroots movement where people who were just ordinary, everyday people did extraordinary things. And I think they did what each one of us can do if we're willing to commit to it.
And that, I think, is the importance of telling the stories about people like Ruby Doar Smith Robinson, that ordinary people can make extraordinary change, and that social movements do require the efforts of many, many people, not just the visions and the charisma of luminaries such as Martin Luther King Jr. or Rosa Parks.
Yes, very true. And that, for me, has been one of the biggest satisfactions of my work, is that I get to tell stories of people whose stories would be lost if I hadn't happened to come along and hear that story.
And how did you hear the story about Ruby Doar Smith Robinson? That's kind of an interesting
last... that really is a great story in itself. When I took the job here at the University of Tennessee 24 years ago, I was at a reception shortly after I arrived, and I met a local black activist whose name is Avon Rollins. And Avon had been in SNCC and had been a colleague of Ruby's. And after I talked to him for a few minutes, and he asked me what I taught, and I told him, and he said, oh, well, somebody needs to write about, and he started telling me about Ruby Doar Smith Robinson, and I'd never heard of her, because I at the time I did 19th century black history. So he said, well, do you have any graduate students? I said, no, I just got here. So from then on, for about 3 or 4 years, every time I would see Avon, we would have this same conversation. Do you have any graduate students? No, I don't have any graduate students. Well, after several years of this, he finally looked at me one day and he said, I know you don't have any graduate students. Why don't you do it? And I said, no, I'm trained in the 19th century. I can't do that. I'm a specialist. This man hounded me for, oh, 3 more years or so. And finally, I got so tired, and this really is a true story, I got so tired of hearing him. I said, okay, I'll make a deal with you. I will look and just read a little bit about her in the literature if you promise to leave me alone. He knew I'd be hooked, and that's what started it.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today on KABU, Cynthia Griggs Fleming.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Next, at 10 o'clock on Health Watch, the guest is Dr. Mark Weisbluth, a pediatrician and sleep researcher. He'll talk about his book, Healthy Sleep Habits, Healthy Child. At 10:30 on the environment with Scott Forrester, the issues are mining near Mount St. Helens, Portland's wholesale water contracts, and the future of public electric power. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, remembering Betty Friedan and Munster Grandpa Al Lewis, who is an activist and longtime host on community radio. And that's it today for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Oh, what a lovely, precious dream. Just